things not only decriminalizing prostituted person, the person who's being sold, but the sex industry, which is an international criminal organization that preys upon the most vulnerable women and children of both sexes. But especially
who are you often usually people of color, poor people of color?
People of color, people in poverty, people of color, and abused kids, runaways. A pimp can spot a runaway,
right?
You know, at 100 paces, and they, you know, they their recruitment techniques are all about, you know, promising to be the daddy they never had.
Well, you talk about it. You liken it to the way cults recruit.
No, they use the same methods, of course, of control, love bombing at first. And then very quickly, you know, the imposition of the same methods of course of control that torturers use, and you know, that violence, but also control.
Great. We're going to stop there. That was Dr. Judith Herman, author of Truth and Repair, How Trauma Survivors Envision Justice. I want to thank the Real News Network and its production team, Cameron Granadino, David Hebden, and Kayla Rivera. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
The time now is 1 minute past 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly coming up here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Black Agenda Radio, where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Margaret Kimberly. In this week's segment, we learn about a successful judgment against the city of New York after a newborn was illegally separated from his mother, and how dissent is criminalized in Georgia against Stop Cop City protesters. But first, we hear about just one example of corporate media bias against the nation of Nicaragua. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Camila Escalante is an editor for Calcetín News and a Latin America correspondent for Press TV. She joins us from Managua, Nicaragua, to discuss a recent segment of the National Public Radio podcast Up First, which featured an interview with Eder Peralta, an NPR correspondent, who reported on a recent visit to Nicaragua in which he made many untrue statements. We will talk about how corporate media serves state propaganda. Tell our listeners just an overview of what was wrong with this interview.
Well, NPR featured an interview and story as part of its Sunday Story, which is a podcast segment. A lot of these are available online, but they're also aired on the public airwaves. That is NPR. Of course, a lot of people are getting their coverage online more than listening to the radio the way we used to. But this story is 40 minutes long. It is a story produced by, as you said, Eder Peralta, who is a Nicaraguan citizen. He's interviewed and brought on by the host, Aisha Rasco. And they have this whole story and angle about Nicaragua and how difficult it is for foreign press to enter the country and report in the country. And it makes the big claim at the start of the story that he is the first journalist, foreign journalist. Of course, he means, I would presume that he means journalists working for a foreign outlet to be able to enter the country and report in over a year is what he claims, which is factually incorrect just from the start without getting into any of the details of what sort of information is framed and inserted into this report. Also, Aisha Rasco says what she says when she's promoting it on social media is that they have this exclusive reporting from this reporter of NPR, Eder, which foreign journalists have been banned and human rights are under attack in Nicaragua. It's completely false from the outset that foreign journalists have been banned. I myself am a Canadian journalist. I work for different media outlets, both freelance and other capacity. I have my own outlet, none of which are Nicaraguan or have any ties to anything in Nicaragua. We're completely foreign. And also, I've been here for a couple of months, and during this time, I've seen a lot of foreign media come in and out and do different types of story, both for broadcast journalism, you know, both TV and radio, also a lot of writers, all of them foreign, some of them working for more mainstream outlets, both including public radio in the United States, and also including state media outlets from different correspondents for state media outlets from around the world. And so we can refute point for point, you know, a lot of the different claims that were made in this story, a lot of the misinformation in this 40-minute NPR piece, and describe the actual conditions here in Nicaragua, which I think are very important to talk about. But I think ultimately, you know, what this demonstrates is that the approach that this U.S. state media is taking is fundamentally flawed in the ways in which they approach covering different countries like Nicaragua, a country that is under siege by the United States and has, the United States has a certain foreign policy towards Nicaragua. But at the same time, we see these same press outlets, whether it be PBS or NPR or any of the other mainstream outlets in the U.S. doing some really poor reporting on other countries and other parts of the world, but primarily the global South, where they kind of use as, you know, to their advantage, the fact that a lot of people in the United States have never been to these countries for one reason or another. They, you know, don't travel a whole lot or get out a whole lot. So they don't actually know what the conditions are in these different countries. And for that reason, they're able to make all of the outrageous claims that we hear made by the State Department, by the White House, and all of the other different departments and agencies of the United States government. And they're simply just reiterating them in the form of, you know, this sort of storytelling approach to this reporter's experience here in Nicaragua when he came in, starting with how he entered the country. He, a Nicaraguan citizen with a Nicaraguan passport, entered through a border checkpoint by land, entering in through immigration on the Honduras-Nicaraguan border. And he himself says that he had no problems entering. This is right at the start of the story, if anyone wants to listen to it. And he wasn't questioned at all. He was able to immediately enter Nicaragua without any problems whatsoever, which he seems to attribute to him being Nicaraguan. But as I can see here, and as anyone can tell you here, there are a lot of foreigners here. There are a lot of people who come here on vacation for cultural reasons, for different people-to-people exchanges, or to participate in certain events, or for business and for investment. And all of these people are coming in with their foreign passports without any problems. Also, like I said, a long list of foreign journalists. So he himself didn't have any issue. I'm not sure what exactly he's referring to in terms of who is being barred from entering the country. If he were to have to ask any questions or answer any questions about his occupation, I would expect that he would answer those, because in my case, I've had to, as a foreign correspondent and as a reporter, over the course of several years, I've had to travel, as you know, Margaret, through multiple Latin American countries, both with, you know, all sorts of different governments who were, you know, seated at the time. And I've had to tell the immigration authorities what my occupation is, what I do, and what I intend to do. He didn't even have to do that, it seems, when he entered the country successfully to be able to do his reporting.
You know, you make many good points there. He makes this these very dramatic statements about entering through a remote border crossing on the border with Honduras, and he was afraid he'd be turned away. And then he says, well, actually, 5 minutes later, I got in. So it was, they build up this story about an authoritarian regime, and then he makes statements that contradict the premise of this story, calling it the most, at one point, the most authoritarian government in the world. By what measure is Nicaragua authoritarian at all, first of all, and even if that definition fit the most authoritarian government in the world, I mean, we have an elected president, an elected vice president, an elected legislature, and yet it's called authoritarian. And it seems to me it's pretty clear that he is one of those journalists, I use the word loosely, quite frankly, who promote the narrative of the U.S. state. The U.S. has been hostile to Nicaragua ever since the Sandinistas came to power in 1979. We had the Reagan administration spending basically the entirety of his time in office trying to overthrow that government, giving money to people who were called the Contra rebels. The current government, the Biden administration, they passed legislation called the Renacer Act. Renacer meaning rebirth in Spanish. It's an awful term, frankly, and it's sanctions and it's ways to punish Nicaragua and to make life more difficult for the people there. Wonder if that's authoritarian or not. But at any rate, this is quite a problem when people who are journalists who are acting under a pretense of objectivity spread state propaganda, spread what I would call war propaganda. Is that not the problem?
Absolutely. Well, a lot of people would consider NPR, among other outlets in the United States, including those that receive public funding, which many people believe to be more progressive outlets. This is, in fact, the issue is that people are getting information from outlets which they believe are more progressive, a more neutral and more transparent and more ethical sources of information compared to the other large corporate media. Of course, NPR is also corporate media. And so this is the problem. They are acting like any other psychological warfare outlet. And so what does this guy do in his reporting? He interviews one person who he takes a quote from in his interview is actually a State Department official who speaks anonymously and, you know, says all of the things that we're used to hearing them say, you know, quite publicly, but he doesn't even name his source. There's another person who he interviews who is among those who were convicted here in Nicaragua and in the negotiations that took place between the State Department and Managua, they were sent to the United States. And of course, they were given essentially a sort of amnesty because they were released from prison and they're able to live lives normally in the United States. Many of these people already had lived in the United States previously, and a lot of their lives and everything else are there. This person who they spoke to, he even describes as someone who self-describes as being anti-socialist and anti-Sandinista. And he's saying this, and, you know, this person is part of the narration of the entire story. He's talking about his time when he was arrested and jailed here, and trying to make some sort of a point, but he doesn't actually speak to anyone in this story, in terms of any quotes or anything, who supports the government, which I find very difficult to wrap my head around, because this is a country that has huge support, you know, in the 70%, or higher range of people who support the government, particularly in this period since Daniel Ortega, the president, won the presidency in 2021. So a lot of very false and inaccurate claims are made. A lot of really bizarre angles are taken. They claim that there's a political crisis in this country when there simply is no political crisis. I think we're going to have to define what political crisis is, because I'm here now and that doesn't exist. Unfortunately, there are political crises in different parts of Latin America right now, namely in countries like Ecuador, where we're getting a new round of elections and there's going to be a new president because the situation there is so severe. Another one is the political crisis in neighboring Honduras, which is a country that has a leftist government and in which they have had a very difficult time renewing the authorities of the prosecutor's office in order to prosecute some of the people who carried out acts of corruption in the previous administration. And so actually there are different things that this person could be reporting on, but instead of chasing those, he's making false accusations about another country. He says that the country has been in constant turmoil. But he has not mentioned the U.S. intervention in this country repeatedly over the last several decades and actually the last couple of centuries, including U.S. military interventions here in Nicaragua and the way in which the country and its authorities and people are provoked militarily with numerous military bases and operations taking place in this region of the world around Central America and the Caribbean as well. And so all sorts of different things are referenced. He references this UN human rights report. Another person is interviewed who claims that seven presidential candidates were barred from running, when in fact, this is one of the most important things I've covered here during my time in 2021 in Nicaragua. I was not living here. I was based in Bolivia, but I came here and interviewed authorities of the electoral court, the electoral authorities here, and interviewed them asking who is running, who is registered to run, and trying to get a clear idea of what happened. Clearly, these were people who are just quote unquote, who were potential candidates. They were human beings with the capacity to, I don't know, affiliate themselves at one point or another with a political party. Many of them did not. They did not register in terms of doing the different paperwork that is necessary and approaching the electoral authorities to be able to inscribe in the election as a presidential candidate. It's completely false that anything happened to pre-candidates or candidates because they simply didn't exist. You know, these words have meanings, and we need to see who was actually a presidential candidate that year, and these people never were. And so this is just points to a larger problem of how the press operates, particularly when news has to be sensationalized or clickbaity. And that continues to happen more and more, particularly now in the age of social media. The only way for people to support this type of reporting that he's doing on NPR and for him to be hired really and to continue to do this type of work is to have an angle that is appreciated or sought after by the U.S. authorities or by a particular U.S. audience. Otherwise, there would just be no demand for it whatsoever. Unfortunately, there are many good stories about the different protagonists and the different struggles here in Latin America that news outlets, even the most progressive outlets, ones that I work for, don't accept because they are busy chasing stories that are sensational. They want to hear about coups. They want to hear about governments falling. They want to hear about hardship and misery and disaster porn, quite frankly. And they want to see these different governments attacked and slashed slandered as authoritarian, as dictators, and so forth.
Yes, and it's always those governments that the U.S. doesn't like, and I guess we could sum up by saying governments that are socialist. Those are considered enemies. They are targeted. They are smeared. Last year in Los Angeles, the U.S. was the host of the summit of the Americas and deliberately excluded leaders from Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela. It's the summit of the Americas. It's not the summit of the United States, even if it's in the United States. But it's that kind of thing that the press follows without questioning. And it says a lot about the state of what is supposedly journalism in this country, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There was very little questioning of why In the U.S. media during this period, the run-up to the Summit of the Americas, as you said, was held in Los Angeles last year, no one really questioned why those three countries were not receiving an invitation to participate in that summit. That's supposed to be a summit of only, 35 countries or whatever it is, our region. Why exclude these three? People were just in their reporting, regurgitating the same lines that we were hearing from, the OAS, the State Department, and the White House, and not really asking any deep questions about it. Well, going back to NPR and its really bad reporting on this region, particularly on Nicaragua, this is not the first time that it's put out such reporting. In recent years, it has lent itself to this sort of anti-Sandinista, anti-government propaganda and has published some reporting on the COVID response, the response of the government to COVID-19 in the last few years, framing it as a sort of failed response in comparison to other countries of the region. We know that that's not the case at all. Well, getting back to the story, and a lot of other claims were made that were simply bizarre. He says that Daniel Ortega only understands the language of violence. Now, this is a story, or this is a country that is completely safe. There's a very low level of violence in the country. People are able to walk, go to work, go to school peacefully. Very few robberies, assaults, and a very low level of homicide, particularly compared to other countries of the region. He doesn't say that. What he does says is that when you enter the country, you see that it's, you know, oddly calm or normal. I mean, he himself says that none of these things that are, you know, supposedly wrong with the country, as per the propaganda and the media coverage, are simply not visible at first sight. But the reality is they're not visible because these things simply don't exist. And for that reason, a lot of foreigners have been buying homes here or have been trying to come here to vacation and for other purposes, because it's just a more pleasurable experience for them compared to some of the neighboring countries. It's just simply the most peaceful country in the region. He also says, you know, in this story, Ader actually attends, or he tries to attend, the celebrations marking the 44th anniversary of the triumph of the revolution, which of course is on July 19th. And he paints a picture of security measures being set up ahead of the official central act. And he's making it seem like some very mysterious event that's supposed to take place. But it's a very important event that takes place, that's watched on television by the entire country, and where there are many high-ranking officials, like presidents of national assemblies and congresses from foreign governments, and other ambassadors and other dignitaries come here from overseas, from every continent and corner of the world, in order to participate in these celebrations. So there is some level of security that takes place there and some preparations that have to take place. But he doesn't say anything about the fact that all sorts of activists and people who are not screened in any way, who are just in the audience, run up to President Daniel Ortega to shake his hand and give him gifts during this event, basically not going through any sort of security barrier. It's clear that, you know, he has a disposition, which is that he likes to shake people's hands and get to see people. But one of the claims that was made is that clearly Daniel Ortega doesn't want to hold big public rallies. That is another absurd claim, because until COVID-19, they had been holding massive rallies that only had to change, obviously, for the reasons that we know in 2020 and thereafter. But a lot of different public acts are taking place, including the parades that have just taken place in the last 2 weeks. There have been two large police and military parades in commemoration of certain anniversaries that went down central avenues with the attendance of the public. So these things are taking place, and obviously he didn't stick around to see them happen.
Yeah, it's very, and I just want to tell our listeners, I also have been to Nicaragua and written about my observations and my experiences there. And of course, a president has security. What head of state doesn't have security? And, you know, as far as he doesn't like to hold large public events, he appears in public like anyone else who runs for office. So, but these things are clearly untrue, but there's a larger purpose being served here. And I believe it is to get buy-in from the public so that when Nicaragua is sanctioned or there's some sort of interference in the affairs of that country, that people will go along with it because they have been told that it's an evil authoritarian state. And this is, frankly, it's nothing but war propaganda, in my opinion.
Absolutely. So what is the objective here? Well, right now, we're going to continue to see more of these sorts of propaganda hit pieces that take aim at Nicaragua and this government, because for the time being, Nicaragua is being singled out by the State Department and by U.S. legislators who are right now trying to pass a new piece of legislation, which is currently, I believe, in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And that was penned and is being sponsored by Marco Rubio and Senator Tim Kaine. This is a new piece of legislation to amend the RENACER Act and the NECA Act, two pieces of law that were passed in recent years, which make it very difficult for Nicaragua to access loans from international financial institutions, as well as technical assistance, things that are very much needed. There are a lot of different things which are shoved into the text of this legislation, which have very little to do with human rights or democracy, as it's kind of premised in the beginning. They talk about Nicaragua's relations with Russia and China and the way in which they are, you know, strengthening relations with these other countries overseas. I'm not really sure what, you know, what that geopolitical aspect has to do with the domestic policies of a government and their people. It also talks about religious freedom, because after so many years of pretending that there's, you know, things wrong with, I don't know what it is, the tax system, or that students are upset or whatever else. Now they're trying to say that this government is being repressive towards those of a certain religious faith, being the Catholic Church. It's a country where people are, you know, practicing many different religions, but primarily they are Christians of different denominations and Catholic, and other sorts of just absolutely absurd things in that text. But what is so worrying about this new piece of legislation is that they want to impose sanctions, and they want to ensure the standardization of sanctions from their allied countries, which is to say that in the Renacer Act, it says that they are going to work, the United States will work with the UK, the EU, and Canada to set the same designations and sanctions against Nicaragua, which means a much broader set of sanctions against the country, and that they will work within the multilateral system, which is using the United Nations system and its different bodies, including the UN Human Rights in Geneva, and even the General Assembly in the form of a draft resolution vote, to try to attack the country even further. So they could potentially be very far-reaching, particularly given that it's such a small country with a smaller economy, and that it's a developing country, just like the majority of countries that are illegally sanctioned right now in the world all come from the Global South.
And that was Camila Escalante discussing a biased NPR report on events in Nicaragua. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Ann Van Huysen is an attorney in the Bronx Defenders Impact Litigation Practice. She joins us from New York City to discuss Bronx Defenders litigation on behalf of Shenetto Rivers, whose newborn baby was taken from her illegally by the Administration for Children's Services. Bronx Defenders secured a $75,000 judgment from the city of New York on behalf of Ms. Rivers. We will discuss her case and the problematic nature of what is supposed to be child protection. Tell our listeners about Shenetto Rivers, what happened to her, and why her baby was taken from her, and why that was illegal.
Shenetto Rivers is a Black mother. She lives in the Bronx, and she was pregnant and had a baby boy in August of 2021. The hospital tested her for drugs. This is something that happens disproportionately to Black mothers and to Black people who are pregnant. Ms. Rivers tested positive for cannabis. At the time, cannabis use was and is legal under the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act. ACS, despite this law that allows cannabis use, ACS removed Ms. Rivers' baby boy from her. ACS filed a case against her. ACS attempted to place her newborn in foster care. The judge said no. And then they continued to prosecute her for months, despite this being illegal. It's illegal under the MRTA, as I mentioned before, which had been recently passed. ACS also had its own policy that says they couldn't do this, that essentially matched what the MRTA also prohibited. Despite their own policy, despite the MRTA, ACS still did this because ACS treats Black parents differently, just like they did to Ms. Rivers.
And this testing of a mom giving birth, is this something done routinely in New York City hospitals?
This is a problem in New York City hospitals, particularly, again, testing of Black parents and parents of color. There have been movements to address this because because these hospitals don't provide informed consent in this situation. The hospital did not inform and get Ms. Rivers' consent prior to testing her. While this is also an illegal practice, the actions that ACS took once receiving the report from the hospital are even more egregious. ACS routinely blames mandated reporters, such as the hospital, for the racial disproportionalities that exist within their system, which is true. Mandated reporters do make reports against Black parents at much higher rates. Yet ACS, once they receive a report, only exacerbate those racial disproportionalities, which is what they did with Ms. Rivers. They know that these mandated reporters are making unjustified reports, yet they, in this case, they took the ultimate step of removing Ms. Rivers' newborn from her care.
What hospital was this?
This hospital was Bronx Care. It used to be called Bronx Lebanon.
And is there anything that Bronx defenders or other advocates are doing about this testing and the disparities of testing in New York City hospitals?
Yes, we are. There is a campaign called Informed Consent. This is essentially a campaign to get a bill passed that would require hospitals, bill passed in the New York State Legislature, that would require hospitals to inform parents of their rights and to get meaningful consent from parents and from people who are pregnant prior to the testing. There has been an investigation by the New York City Committee on Human Rights into hospital drug testing. There has been reports that Black parents are tested more frequently than white parents at these hospitals. So there is a movement to try and address this particular problem, which does exist in New York City and which Ms. Rivers was a victim of. In addition to trying to address what ACS did in this case.
They did the testing when she was in labor or after she had given birth?
They did the test in Ms. Rivers' case shortly after birth.
What happened then? Did they tell her about the result?
They did not immediately tell her about the results. Ms. Rivers gave birth on the end of August. That day, she was tested, as was her newborn. The next day, the hospital called in a report to ACS. Again, Ms. Rivers and the newborn are still in the hospital. 2 days after Ms. Rivers had given birth, ACS told the hospital they could not release the newborn to Ms. Rivers. So Ms. Rivers wasn't allowed to take her newborn home from the hospital. ACS didn't file a case against her, despite, you know, a different law that says you must file a case immediately if you're going to separate a parent and a child. ACS didn't file the case against her until a couple of days later, where they not only filed the case against Ms. Rivers, but they also asked a judge to place the child in foster care. At this point, the child had just been essentially remaining in the hospital until the judge made a decision. This case went in front of not one, but two judges. It was right before Labor Day, so, you know, some vacation schedules impacting that. Neither judge approved ACS's request, and the second judge sent Ms. Rivers' baby home with her, which is what the law requires.
The basis for her, the judgment, her winning this judgment of $75,000, which I've never heard of before. I'm assuming that's unusual for people to be able to win against the ACS.
Sure. So Ms. Rivers essentially had two main claims, and the judgment comes out of those two claims. Obviously, ACS doesn't say, oh, we're giving you $75,000 because we violated your rights under a particular claim. In fact, they won't admit any wrongdoing at all. The main claims that Ms. Rivers has against ACS is, as we've discussed, they violated her rights under this new marijuana law that says that if you use cannabis, the government can't take action against you, including in your parenting, unless they have actual proof of your cannabis use causing harm to your child. In this instance, they didn't have any proof of that. There has been, there's 25 years of case law stating that a positive toxicology for any drug, cannabis or anything else, does not meet the standard. You need to have more than that. And in this case, ACS didn't have any more than that. So that was one major claim that Ms. Rivers brought. As far as we know, it was the first of its kind for a parent to enforce their rights against ACS under this new law. The second claim was an equal protection claim. Ms. Rivers was treated differently because she was Black. ACS treats Black parents differently than they do certainly white parents. This has been demonstrated repeatedly through ACS's own data. ACS has acknowledged this numerous times in numerous different formats. This is something I saw prior to joining the impact litigation practice. I represented parents in the Bronx for over 10 years, something I saw routinely, that Black parents were punished for the same sort of behaviors or activities that I or other white parents would engage in. In Ms. Rivers' particular case, ACS had every reason and legal mandate not to take the actions they did, but they took them anyway because they cannot move away from their racist treatment of Black parents.
And, you know, you mentioned mandated reporting. So there are people, as we're discussing, in hospitals or schools or others who are mandated to report what they think is abuse or neglect. And that is very problematic. In a lot of, though, and I'm sure you know this, as in many, especially neglect cases, generally families are poor. Child may miss a meal or something like that. If a child or a parent reveals anything that could raise anybody's eyebrows who's a mandated reporter, then the parents can and the kids can get caught up in the system, including home visits that include police, accompanying social workers. So this is a problem in the way this is carried out, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it's ironic that ACS acknowledges it as a problem. They have advocated publicly that mandated reporters and the system that the mandated reported system that's currently set up of, as you said, teachers, doctors, you know, kind of other professionals making these reports, creates a major issue in that there are way more reports of Black children being allegedly neglected or abused than there are white children. Black children are over six times more likely to be reported than white children. And ACS acknowledged this is a racist disproportionality that has to be addressed and has to be changed. Again, one of the frustrating things is that once children are reported to ACS, ACS has, as we've described, every reason to treat reports regarding Black children with more suspicion because they know that there's overreporting of Black children and that there is this racial disproportionality. Yet they exacerbate the racial disproportionality once they come in contact with these, you know, with Black families. And that is a major issue, particularly given, as you stated, when mandated reporting is connected to poverty, that creates major problems. Poverty causes so much stress. I heard recently poverty is a full-time job to go through all of the systems. And that's certainly something that Black parents have to experience, poor Black parents who are living in poverty in New York City experience. And then they have the added stress of dealing not only with the mandated reporters that they are required to interact with at a greater level than people who are not living in poverty, you know, certainly many white parents. They also have to interact with ACS while, you know, certainly blaming some of the racial disproportionality on mandated reporting doesn't seem to have or hasn't taken the action to address how that impacts the Black families that they are supposed to be working with.
I just thought of something which, I want to know if it's still the case. There have been women who are in domestic violence situations who are threatened with removal of their kids when they aren't abusing their kids. And so you have women who don't want to report being abused, being in a violent situation, because they may lose their children. What is the current state of those rules and removal of kids?
So it's an interesting, you brought up as someone who, again, that's not something I do now, but having practiced for many years in family court, what you're the case that addressed this and essentially said, you need to do more than this is it's called Nicholson v. Scapetta, but it is a court of appeals case that told ACS, you can't just take children from someone who is experiencing interpersonal violence but is not being violent to their children without trying to offer some support, without there being imminent risk to that child, without making sure you can take efforts to ensure that that child stays in the home. It is a landmark case and is cited probably every day in New York family courts, certainly by people who are representing parents. The unfortunate thing is that this still happens. People who are, you know, victims of interpersonal violence, they do have their children removed if they haven't been able to protect them, or if they haven't taken the specific actions that ACS wants them to take. As I'm sure, Margaret, you're aware, how people respond to conflicts in their relationships is diverse. There's nuance there, and not everyone wants the same sort of measures in their life, and how people deal with those relationships looks different. But ACS requires a very set of specific actions to be taken. You must separate and you must keep your kids away from this person, which creates a lot of problems for people who then not only are threatened by ACS, they have ACS surveilling them. They now have ACS in their life. ACS is saying, if you don't take these specific actions, we are going to remove your children. They face that threat. They may also be losing a support system while it has its problems. That support system is something they need. Perhaps their partner is the person who picks the children up from school and cares for them. That their partner actually is great with the kids, but they themselves have this sort of relationship that they need to repair, work out, or separate, or do something, a choice that should be theirs. And ACS doesn't allow for that choice, which often creates more stress. Now, for some people, being able to separate completely from a violent partner, having no contact, creating those boundaries, that's what works best for them. And that's what they should be able to do. But that certainly isn't the universal choice. But ACS cannot think beyond that very narrow box in creating these, you know, in creating quote unquote safety for children. So yes, it is very much something that is litigated every day in Bronx family court or in New York City family courts. And certainly for parents of color, certainly for Black parents, this is a huge issue still within the community.
And the other issue of reporting, and I just want to be clear that, you know, no one's in favor of children being abused, but we're not in favor of families being treated unfairly and having kids wrongfully taken out of their homes, is that when there are reports, ACS social workers will go to the home. They also always have police with them. Parents don't have to let them in. They don't have to open the door, but people don't always know that. And while Miranda rights are, I believe, required for other police interactions, they're not required in that situation. And that is something the city has said it would not change. Am I correct about that?
You are correct. That is all true. ACS does come to people's houses. They do come with the police. And people do have the right to say no. You have to come back with a warrant. You have to come back within, like, essentially an order that allows entry, that they would have to go to a family court, that parent would have the right to contest. All of those things exist for parents. But again, ACS doesn't inform parents of those rights. Now, ACS will say, well, we want to inform parents later on. But parents, just as with Miranda rights, need to be informed at the beginning. Having information is power, and is a huge step forward in ensuring that parents have some choice and that there is some limits on ACS. There is a bill within the New York State Legislature that puts forward essentially Miranda rights for parents, requiring ACS to inform parents of these rights, which exist. It's not just because ACS is hiding them doesn't mean it's not true. If a parent finds out about them on their own, they're absolutely and should assert their rights. That is what, frankly, I think any lawyer would recommend. ACS has objected to this bill. They continue to object to it, even though in 2020, ACS conducted an internal audit with another organization of racist disproportionalities. And one of the recommendations was to support this family Miranda bill. This is one way that we can cabin what ACS is doing while still ensuring that children are protected, but also that parents are making safe and right decisions for their children. As you stated, no one wants children to be abused. But one of the things that's important to remember is that when ACS removes children, even for short periods, that causes an incredible amount of harm and trauma. That doesn't even get to the harm and trauma that happens when children are removed for long periods of time. That is a defining moment for both the parent and the child that we can never fully repair. And that sort of harm and trauma is not necessarily recognized for the damage that it does.
Before we close, tell our listeners how they can find out about the work of Bronx Defenders or utilize your services should they need them.
We have a website, bronxdefenders.org. There's so much information on there regarding all kinds of different practices. The Bronx Defenders practices in criminal court. We defend people who are accused of crimes. We defend parents in family court. We defend people facing eviction, housing, loss of benefits. We work with people who are fighting to remain in the country. We have an immigration practice. There are so many different ways that Bronx Defenders wants to work with the Bronx community. And if we can't help you, we'll try to find someone or someone else that can assist in your particular need. You can also always call our office, 718-838-7878, if you have an issue. And we'll direct you to who we can. We do offer a lot of different supports for people, and we want to be able to, you know, help the Bronx community.
Does the name indicate that your services are only for Bronx residents?
So we do generally only provide services for Bronx residents. There are exceptions to this, and there are things that go beyond this in certain ways. So I would say to anyone who is facing an issue, certainly an issue like what Ms. Rivers is facing, they can reach out to our office and we can either connect them with people who might be in their particular borough. We have connections with people who work upstate. If that's the case, we can make those connections. We do generally only work with people who are in the Bronx.
And that was Ann Van Huysen of the Bronx Defenders, discussing the case of Shenetto Rivers and the judgment she won after the city of New York illegally removed her baby. You're listening to Black Agenda Radio. I'm Margaret Kimberly. Christopher Bruce is policy director of Georgia ACLU. He joins us from Atlanta to discuss the indictments of 61 Stop Cop City activists in Atlanta and the criminalization of dissent. Tell our listeners, we've been writing about Cop City and the protests against it, the referendum, but can you bring all our listeners up to speed on these indictments and why they are so problematic?
Yes. So as you have mentioned before, 61 individuals were indicted under RICO charges. This is a breathtakingly broad and unprecedented use of RICO, state terrorism, and money laundering laws against protesters. And our Attorney General, Chris Carr, is wielding these sweeping laws to stigmatize and target those who disagree with the government. So as we know, democracy requires dissent, and Georgia officials should not be exposing people to potentially decades worth of prison time for engaging in protests.
This is not the first, as you say, breathtaking law enforcement action. People have been charged with domestic terrorism. Explain to us, and I've heard of some of those individuals now have had bank accounts closed, can't get onto airplanes. Tell us about the domestic terrorism charges.
Yeah, and that's what I was mostly concerned about. So I was one of the few people in Georgia to speak out against SB1. SB1 was the Georgia domestic terrorism statute that was passed in 2017. It was one of my first jobs of saying this law specifically would be used to quell political dissent. And fast forward 5-6 years later, that is exactly what it's being used for. Georgia's domestic terrorism law basically summarizes, if you do anything to interfere with critical infrastructure of the government or anything of the like, you can be charged with domestic terrorism, something with mandatory minimums and potentially decades worth of prison time. So, yes, Georgia's domestic terrorism law is being used in this situation to literally quell people who do not agree with the government.
What you just said, though, is very vague, interfering with critical infrastructure. What does that mean? It sounds like that could mean just about anything.
And that's exactly what you see in this indictment. Just about anyone or anything is being indicted. When you're being indicted for buying glue, when you're being indicted for being reimbursed for $25 or $15 for living in the forest, when you're being indicted for going to a concert, for handing out flyers under RICO charges, these are serious penalties, felonies that you're facing. And once you have a domestic terrorism charge on you, like you had said before, charge. Remember, we live in the United States of America where just because you're charged does not mean that you're guilty. We always have this creed of innocent until proven guilty. And yet we're hit with these parade of horribles of not being able to rent an apartment anymore because you have this charge. Not being able to jump on an airplane, not being able to use a banking account because the government is accusing you of domestic, accusing, you still have not been found guilty, accusing you of dealing with domestic terrorism in a political context too. This isn't a 9/11 context. This isn't some big Timothy McVeigh type of context. We're talking about people who are literally out there trying to defend forests and standing up for the rights of believing that you could spend $90 million on building a training facility or reinvesting $90 million into healthcare, into education in these starving communities, into security, into any and everything else that has been linked to public safety increasing instead of giving it to the police.
You made reference to people being charged because of small expenses, and you're referring to the bail fund providing mutual aid for those who had been arrested. There was a SWAT team that arrested people. They've been charged with money laundering. This was before the RICO indictments.
Correct. So this indictment flies in the face of the First Amendment protections for protesters, organizers, and social justice fundraisers, like you were saying before. Turning association with a social justice movement into criminal conduct. And we know that's dangerous. Why is that dangerous? Because this isn't the first time it's happened. It won't be the last time. So I say it's not the first time because the ACLU established the first large-scale bail fund over 100 years ago. And bail funds and mutual aid networks have been integral to social justice movements ever since. So this isn't just something that we've seen happening right now. This is going to have ramifications in the future of people who decide on exercising their First Amendment rights, exercising their right to bail people out of jail are being charged. These charges should not stand. They should be dropped immediately.
And RICO, the 61 individuals, you know, RICO statutes were meant to charge organized crime figures, but they have said that any activity, and it, well, there's another thing that's interesting, two things. One, they chose the date of George Floyd's murder as the date that this so-called conspiracy began. And secondly, there is at least one individual who wrote his name as ACAB, A-C-A-B, all cops are bastards. And that was claimed as proof that he was part of a criminal conspiracy. Tell us about how this RICO statutes are used in the state of Georgia.
Georgia's RICO statute was passed in 1981. It was based on the federal statute that tried to go after crime mob bosses or any other type of organized crime. It wasn't intended to be used against protesters. In Georgia, reflecting off of that, and even now today, you can look this up. Google OCGA 16-14-2. And I am quoting it straight from what is on the books right now. It is not the intent of the General Assembly that isolated incidents of misdemeanor conduct or acts of civil disobedience be prosecuted under this chapter, end quote. That's in the law. That is exactly what they have contemplated before at the Georgia General Assembly when they passed this law. And now it is being used because they were scared it was going to be used for that purpose of political dissent. And now it's being used for the purpose of political dissent.
Are literally
violating the state's laws by charging these 61 folks with RICO crimes.
Correct. We're talking about the head prosecutor. The state's attorney general is not even following the law. Attorney General Chris Carr has his sights on the governor's mansion, and he's using this political process and exposing people to decades worth of prison time for his own political gain.
What role is the ACLU playing in these cases?
We are not defending anyone personally. We're giving that to other private attorneys and other social justice groups who are doing a formidable job of representing these individuals. And normally we do that to stay out of it, to get a more wide breadth and scope. We're not limited into what we say or do. We do not want to interfere with anyone's case. We want to make sure that these charges are dropped. And specifically because we were at the lead of trying to get rid of the domestic terrorism charges in the first place, we're leading the charge in having that the domestic terrorism law repealed in the state of Georgia. So one, calling for all charges being dropped, these RICO charges, domestic terrorism charges being dropped immediately for these individuals, and two, the complete and utter repeal of Georgia's domestic terrorism statute.
And this repeal, would that be legislative? Would that mean the legislature overturning the statute?
Correct. That would come from the Georgia State Legislature.
Is there anything I have not asked you about these cases that you want the public to know?
I want people to know that Georgia has been ground zero for the political world for probably the last 3 to 5 years. I joke with people saying that Georgia has not been mentioned this much since the Civil War. That's probably the last time it's been this important. But right now it is very important, not just for elections, but for your civil rights and civil liberties. So when I say that RICO charges being used against protesters, this is ground zero. And it could be a blueprint used by other state attorney generals in other states. So this isn't just isolated to a Georgia situation. This could be used all across the country. Let us be clear. There are going to be other protests. There are going to be other cop cities. There are going to be other marches on Washington, March for Women's Rights and everything else. This is going to happen again. What cannot happen are protesters or people who are exercising their First Amendment rights being prosecuted under RICO. So if it does not stop here, expect it in your backyard tomorrow.
Thank you. And how do our listeners find out about the work of the Georgia branch of the ACLU?
Yes, they can go to www.acluga.org.
And that was Christopher Bruce of the Georgia ACLU joining us to discuss the use of RICO statutes against Stop Cop City activists.
Thank you for joining this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue every Wednesday.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be
televised. I'm David Saltman, running for a seat on WBAI's local station board. I've been a broadcast and journalism professional for 50 years. I'm the guy who discovered Gilda Radner and was first to put her on the air. I've been a producer for Charles Kirol on CBS, for Diane Sawyer on ABC, executive producer of documentaries for Ted Turner's CNN, and done 18 hours on PBS. I've raised millions of dollars in public broadcast funding. You can read more about me in Wikipedia. I've been a big fan of WBAI and Pacifica, and it's a crime what's happened there. Vote for me to save and restore one of New York's great institutions. This is David Saltman, running for a seat on WBAI's local station board.
I'm Tessa Lena, and my platform is Letting People Speak. I think it's very important to let people express their own opinions and share what they actually think based on their own lives and experiences. So I grew up in the Soviet Union. I was a child in the USSR, and I know what it's like when people don't have this opportunity. So I really hope that we don't end up with the same here. And seeing what's happening around, I want to do my part to ensure that it doesn't happen. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
My name is Charles Nyejirika. I am running for a seat on WBAI's local station board. I intend to bring to bear my experience in community organizing and community resource mobilization to turn around the fortunes of WBAI. I represent the views and perspectives of the African listening public that are unrepresented and at times underrepresented. I'll bring my experience in resource economics and law and policy to bear so that we can change the fortune of WBAI. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Neil Voss, and I am a candidate for a position on the WBAI local station board. I am currently chair of the WBAI community.